Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Good morning. Welcome to Sawcast number 38. This production of Sawcast is brought to you courtesy of Jocko Willink Productions and his technical staff. Kerry Helton's here today. And my name is John Strykemeyer. I'll be your host for today. And what I'd like to do is to start off with a story from our time on the ground. And we had a recon team, RT Crusader, had been on the ground. They've been in heavy contact for a long period of time, getting low on ammo. It was getting dark, and the team was not in a position to get out. And so the team leader, Rick Estes, was on the radio, tried to make contact, couldn't make contact, and then he picked up his ERK-10, which was our emergency frequency radio, and he clicked on the radio, said, "Can anybody hear me?" And at this point, I want to introduce Rick Estes. Rick, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And that was that one mission was so unique. But it also, maybe before you talk about hitting the radio, what kind of trouble you had been in for how long? I didn't accurately portray the time, perhaps, on that.
Well, we had been on the ground. We got inserted 2 days earlier. So this was the beginning of day three. Mm-hmm. And I was, we got inserted. It was into the DMZ, and we were looking down on the DMZ with some field glasses, and everything had gone fine. We had a good RON location, and we had good field glasses, and so we were monitoring the activity coming across. They were using brew porters to transport goods and stuff across, you know, across the river. So everything had been fine, and then it was about midday, and the brew picked up some noise.
And the brew would be the Montagnard tribesmen that worked with our teams up north.
Yep. The brew were the local tribesmen, and the team was a total brew team. And they heard some noise, and it was myself and Sergeant Bingham. So it was a cough. There was a cough. And very quickly, a firefight broke out and fired towards the noise. Really, we didn't see him at that point, but we knew where he was. And so I threw a grenade, and the net of it was that we shot him. And there didn't seem to be anybody with him.
Finney NVA.
Yeah. So, Finney NVA. So we made the decision to go out and bring him into the RON. We didn't see any other troops. We drug him into to the site, and we took off all of the intel, anything we thought was important. We were looking for Chinese coming down. I mean, that was so we were sensitive to that whole.
That's thing. Part of your intel briefing,
yeah.
Right? Before
yeah.
the mission on mission prep,
because there was some suspicion that Chinese were reinforcing the NVA. So we left him there, and I got on the FM radio to get relief from.
Yeah. Because now your mission is obviously compromised.
Yeah, it's over. It's over. We were at the top of a rocky outcropping, and when that firefight took place, we knew it was finished. So I called for exfil, and every time I tried to call out, I got jammed by a NVA radio operator. In the beginning, I wasn't sure what was happening, but pretty quickly on, it was clear. You know.
So explain a little bit what that means. So, like, ordinarily, you click into it and you have a transmission, but in this case, you couldn't because you could hear something on your ear.
I could hear him as clear as day. I thought maybe he was within a few yards. I didn't know. I was trying to put two and two together as to why he was so, excuse me a sec.
Sure.
Why he sounded so close.
Yeah.
But he might not have been that close. I couldn't tell. But he was talking profanities and trying to jam the radio up. And initially, of course, without realizing what was going on, I'm yelling back at him with, yeah, you know, my own profanities.
You could use the F-bomb if you want.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I did.
These are Jocko podcasts. There you go. Okay. So we use true American language here. Yeah.
So pretty quickly, though, I realized that he was jamming me, and I kept trying to get one of the radio relays or Covey, and I couldn't. And Covey was the aircraft that was right overhead. And they weren't there, and they couldn't hear me. So I told Bingham, and I didn't know. At that point, I didn't really know what to do. But then the IRC-10 came to mind, and I pulled out the IRC-10. Which was the high-frequency emergency radio that we all carried.
Yeah.
And started transmitting on that. But I had no place to go. I mean, I had no freak other just than the emergency freak. And I'm basically saying, you know, any station. I'm an American combat unit under fire.
Yeah.
And I need some assistance. And then out of the blue comes this transmission, and the guy says, unknown station, this is a commercial aircraft flying over Vietnam. And he said, you know, I told him, I basically elaborated what the situation was, and I gave him the freak in the clear. I gave him the FM freak to call, and I says, you got to call and get somebody out here. Because we're in big trouble, and he did. But in the interim, the Brew were getting really pissed about this whole thing because they expected us to be able to get a helicopter anytime we wanted it. I mean, that's you know, we provided the food, the transportation, and everything, and they were saying, you know, goddamn no helicopter and all this kind of thing. And I'm getting in an argument with them, and I'm saying, would you shut up? I'm doing the best I can. I'm trying to get us out of here.
In the middle of a firefight.
Yeah, in the middle of a firefight, you know. So, and all this time, and this was not just a matter of minutes, this was quite a bit of time, they're coming up from the valley, coming up to our location.
The NVA.
Yeah, but we didn't know how many, we didn't know any of that. But then we started taking incoming rounds, and we got in, Covey came out, told me he was going to get us out. So in the meantime, then, we were in a firefight, using up our ammo, and there was no place for the chopper to land. There was no place for it to land.
Right.
So what he had to do, and that's why these chopper pilots are amazing in Vietnam. I mean, you know,
absolutely.
Yeah. It was an American. He came up and he hovered right up next to the rocks, and he told us, that's the best I can do, you know.
Really?
Yeah, and you're going to have to jump from the rocks into the chopper. So we all proceeded to do it, and we tried to bring the KIA with us.
Good. Tell us about the KIA.
Well, he was just laying there.
Oh, the guy who was killed first off.
Yeah, the guy that was killed up first off. And we thought that it might be helpful if we brought the body back.
But they always tell us, if you get the dead body, even bring it back.
So that's what we tried, but it didn't work. Yeah, he was dead, and it was too much trouble, and it was slowing everything down, and the chopper took some rounds, yeah, while we were there. And so anyway, he got left behind, and we all got out, and then got exfilled and came back to Fubai.
They did the whole team with one chopper?
Had to. No choice. Yeah, we were piled on top of each other, and that's all we had. One chopper, one Huey.
And you're down to the last light and last couple of magazines on top of it.
Oh, we'd run out of ammo. I mean, if that chopper, well, we hadn't totally run out. We had a little bit left, but I mean, we wouldn't have lasted very long at all. If that chopper hadn't got there and got us, we would have been screwed because there was no place to go.
And what was your basic load back then?
Oh, you mean
for what you carried? For
I carried 18 magazines, 8 grenades,
Sawed-off M79.
Sawed-off M79. I had a couple of smokes. I don't know.
And
I was loaded for bear.
And you had the radio.
And I had the radio. Yeah, I had the radio. Yeah.
Okay.
So
but that you was, able to get was, out.
Yeah. So we all, wow. I didn't have that much when we left, but I used up my grenades. I used up most of my ammo.
So when the NVR came up the hill, was that in canopy? Or was that
no? It was in canopy. We couldn't see,
but you could hear them coming.
We could hear them coming. They were firing off at us, and we didn't know. You know, we really didn't know what we had there. We knew that there was a hell of a lot of them down in the valley, but that was a long ways up.
Sure.
So, but obviously the tracker. See, we at the time, you go back and you can see that that he was a tracker. But at the time, we weren't quite sure whether there was more behind him or where they were at and all that kind of thing. So yeah. I don't know how far away he got from his unit or had been following us, you know, but he made the fatal error of coughing.
His last cough.
His last cough, yeah. That was the end. So so when we left, we still weren't sure what unit we had come in contact with or anything. We just had to get the hell out of there, and we did.
Indeed.
yeah.
And so was that early on, like one of your first few missions with Crusader?
Yeah, it was. It was, I was actually making the transition, you know.
Right.
I'd done a lot of strap hanging and
Ran one target with Idaho.
I ran one target with Idaho.
Sure.
I would go out with anybody that would take me. So yeah, I was getting broke in on the Crusader.
Yeah.
And Bingham, Sergeant Bingham, went out because he had experience. Now, he died not 2 months after that on a different operation.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. And then God, that just got to take a minute. And across the fence here, RT Idaho, when you were strap hanging with us, mm-hmm. we go into a DMZ target, and the our point man had apparently either broken or severely strained his ankle.
Yeah, he had a bad foot. Yeah,
and so believe the hard thing to believe is that we got inserted, and we called Covey to say, "Hey, our point man, come back and extract him." And from the time they tried to do it, they said they couldn't do it, we got socked in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that was the beginning of 5 days, which turned out to be the five coldest days. And, you know, you and I had been on the ground, I forget if it was the first night or the second night, and we were up on the hilltop. We could hear the NVA moving at night
yeah.
in the canyons below us.
Yeah.
And we knew we were socked in, so we didn't make contact or do anything that would stick out. Just did broke squelch for our comma check at midnight,
yeah.
and then it was dark. And he said, "Going to the book here," said one of my favorite times. I sat there in the dark with Estes, both of us trying to keep our teeth from chattering. "Look," I said, "I know you're from California, but we're going to need each other's body heat to survive out here. I've never been so cold in my entire life. So don't pull any funny stuff."
Just for the record, and I didn't.
You didn't, no, you're right. But we the body heat sure helped.
Yeah, it helped.
That's the coldest I've ever been in my life.
The weather out there, you know, at that elevation in those mountains, it could come in on you like really, really fast.
Yeah.
And then when it did, a lot of times it was zero. You know, that was the famous zero whiskey extra. I mean, you
sure,
couldn't see a
you
damn
couldn't
thing.
See.
So, yeah.
And so that was our situation there
yeah.
for 5 days and five nights. I know each during the days, you and Lynn and maybe one of the indigenous would go down, look at the trail, maybe put a couple of booby traps down
yep,
there.
Yep.
And then we were in on that target. We were in there for 5 days.
5 days, yeah.
And then finally on the sixth day, the weather broke a little bit. Covey came out. We actually see Covey. And we won't talk too much about the rest of that story. We got extracted.
Yeah, we got extracted.
Be at that.
Yeah,
we were
yeah.
all cold. And
yeah.
Our point man's son had a really bad ankle. And he could, that was the bad thing. We just literally couldn't move.
Yeah, he heard
with
it.
With him.
He heard it coming in.
Yeah.
He heard it coming in, yeah.
So going on from there, sir, there was one of the one of the missions I remember the most from you was you were on the ground and in Laos. Your
uh-huh.
team was on the ground. Enemies near you.
Yeah.
7 or 8 clicks away, another team with a 1-0, Richard Jennings was on the ground with Reginald Gray.
Right.
There had been an enemy contact, and you could hear the contact with them.
I couldn't really hear it. No, they were far enough away. I was listening to it on the radio.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So at some point, they're getting into their communications was failing miserably.
Yeah.
And you had to pick up the beat.
Yeah.
And that's what that story that night. That was a long night for you, but take it from the beginning when you knew what's going on. Your team had been in for a day or two, and yeah. Take it from there.
Well, again, a brew team was my brew team. Chuck Willoughby, who is, I think he's a member of the SOA.
He is.
Yeah. Chuck Willoughby was with me, and an officer that I can't remember his name. He showed up and was on that one operation, and I never saw him again. But we had taken our positions, and again, we were monitoring movement down the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Right.
Not the DMZ, but the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Yeah, you're in Laos now.
Yeah. And everything was going pretty routinely. We got settled in. And I heard from Jennings. He had a brew team as well.
Right.
And he was an unknown distance from me, but it wasn't very far. It was probably about what you said, 7-8 kilometers away.
Right.
Yeah. And he checked in. I'm not sure he should have done that, but he checked in and just identified himself. And then I got off the air. I was concerned about talking too much on a radio. Excuse me.
Sure.
About too much airtime because, like you said, you could hear the NVA out there. They knew we were there, but they didn't know exactly where we were.
And we knew they had RDF, radio direction finding equipment.
Oh, yeah. Yes, yeah.
That was always a main concern on the ground.
And so we wanted to keep it low key. I didn't hear any more from Jennings. And then all of a sudden, later that evening, early evening, the shit hit the fan, and Jennings comes on the radio, and he says, "I'm under attack," and I'm trying to get a sense of the situation,
right?
And I'm saying, "Well, you know, are you talking to Lemon Tree or are you talking to Covey?" And he says, "No, I'm not getting anybody." And his transmissions would get shorter and shorter as we talked. So in the beginning, you'd have a normal, but then the length, the duration of the transmission was getting shorter. And what happened, looking at after the fact, was that his radio had taken a round, and it got in the battery, lodged in the battery, and the battery was defective. And so he asked me if I would call for help. For
radio relay.
Yeah, so I was his radio relay, and I didn't like it. I mean, I did. The whole thing was bad. But he was under shit. I mean, you could hear the gunfire going and everything, and he was, him and Reg Gray and his team were surrounded, and they had him pinned. And
up against the mountain, right?
I think it was up against the mountain because he couldn't move.
Yeah.
He couldn't move. Well, darkness started setting in, and he was still fighting, and he was still using me to communicate, and then it got dark, and they set fire to his position. So I'm assuming, you know, he didn't. So he says, "Son of a bitch, they set fire." You know,
they're
trying to burn
me out. I forgot about that part of the story. Sure.
So he went on into the night, and then his battery totally gave out in the middle of the night, and I didn't hear from him anymore. So I looked over at Chuck, and I remember giving it this kind of a sign, you know, and
yeah.
I'm saying
he's cutting your throat.
Yeah, he's screwed. Yeah,
he's
cutting
Finney.
Yeah, he was Finney. Well, he wasn't Finney, and sometime during the night they found the battery, the extra battery, because you're always supposed to carry a backup battery. And he was so rattled during the firefight he couldn't find it. But then he did find it and got back on the air, talked to me again, and then I stopped. I said, "Okay, if you don't need it, I'm out of here."
Sure.
You know, and because we had our own problems too, and then he got exfilled. Him and Reg got exfilled, and I remember it was dark humor, you know, when everything is really shitty. And so I asked Gray. I said, "Would you climb out there and get me one of those NVA belt buckles?" You know. And he said,
He says, "Oh, okay, kayak, I'll try," you know. Yeah. But of course, he's thinking he's full of shit. I'm not going anywhere, you know. Well, they got exfil. They got exfil and made it back, and I think they lost one of their brew. Came out and got hung by the ropes as he was coming out.
Ooh.
And they had one wounded, I believe. But I didn't find this out until quite a bit later because I couldn't get exfil. You know, I couldn't get out. So that was him, and I was his his connection.
Yeah, and then also you were able to help get the connection for the gunship that came in.
I got the connection for everything. He didn't have any commo. He finally lost his battery totally, and but how he got out was the next day. The weather was bad. It was bad for us. It was bad for him. And he got out, but we didn't get out.
So, yeah. But again, during the night, for that period of time, because he wasn't cool-headed. Let's just leave it at that point.
He was absolutely, I don't know how to describe it. I mean, he was under attack. They were trying to.
And they tried to burn him out.
He was on top of it. His position was on fire. He had run out of ammo. He ran out of ammo, and he was using his pistol. And
were throwing stones.
Well, maybe I don't know, but he had his pistol and gray. I don't know about gray, but I would assume they both ran out.
Yeah,
of ammo.
Yeah. Because at some point, for some reason, 2 years later, we were in that target at night using Spectre, and we would throw hand grenades. We're getting low on hand grenades, so Sal Chow went out and got rocks. So you throw a rock, you hear him run away.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, they were scary at night.
Yeah.
And I remember that Jennings, because that was one of the stories that Jennings said, that when they had some hand grenades, and when the enemy get close, they started throwing rocks at him.
I couldn't hear Jennings, but I could hear some of the FM traffic from some of the air, because they brought in, I think they brought in Spectre.
Yeah,
to try to keep them away from him. You know?
They were able to somehow. Spectre, and it wasn't Spectre, it was the after we had Spooky.
Uh-huh.
Then they came up with the C-119s, and the first one was they had Stingers, and then Shadow was the first one. And I think that was when we the first team that I'm aware of, at least from FOB1.
Yeah,
where they said they had Shadow, and it was really good. And it hovered over them, and it circled over them.
Yep.
And then they may have gone through two gunships that night.
They did go through. There were several aircraft that came out there and tried to save his ass.
And they did.
And they did save his ass, but I didn't know it.
Yeah.
I thought he was finished, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, that was a hell of a thing, something that you never expect to happen, you know.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So how does all this... So what leads to you eventually getting into the Army? Where does all this begin? Where did you grow up as a kid?
Oh, you know, can I finish a little bit of the story?
Please, we're not in a hurry.
Okay,
this is Jocko's time.
What happened was, in my case, even though Jennings got out, I couldn't get out. And so we stayed there for a total of 10 days.
That's right.
We weren't supposed to be in there 10 days.
No,
it was supposed to be a 5-day mission, typical, you know, and usually they didn't last that long. But
and you packed light on chow, so you guys got really hungry.
We ate it every damn bit of it. We ate all of our chow. We drank all of our water. We were out at about day 5, and they couldn't come. Bad weather, you know, bad whiskey x-ray.
Oh,
it just kept up and kept up and kept up. And finally, so we started drinking water out of the mud puddles up there. And we had no chow. And then finally, they sent out choppers to get us. They had a break in the clouds. And we bailed onto the helicopter. I sat down on my leg, which is, I don't think I could do it today, but my leg got underneath. And so off we went. And the crew had sandwiches and beer for us. The helicopter crew did, And they knew we hadn't eaten in a long time. You know, so they had beer and sandwiches on the chopper. And we came back, and when I got to Fubai, that's where they brought us, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
There were a lot of guys out there waiting for us, you know, because they had been following the whole thing.
Oh, of course, so yeah. Well, Tony Harrell was worried.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, you know, sometimes the teams didn't come back, you know.
That's right.
And so we came back, we landed there, and there were a bunch of guys out there waiting for us. And that was one of the cooler memories I've got of Vietnam, was coming back and seeing those guys, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So that ended. That was a 10-day mission. Wasn't supposed to be, but that's what it was. Yeah.
God. And then did you hear much enemy activity during the time so you could make intel reports? Or was it one of those deals where...
No, actually what happened was they were out looking for us. They knew we were there, and we could hear them, and we could hear them at night, but they never found us. And we had a good spot. We were behind a lot of rocks,
yeah.
And they just never connected. So...
Your brew team done good.
Yeah, the brew team done good, and we never got to compromise. So anyway,
But I understand what you're saying, because yeah. A lot of times the guys would get out on the launch pad if we knew they were coming back.
Yeah.
Sometimes the team would be pulled and nobody know.
Well, you know, they'd stick around the radio room and check in on the teams, how are they doing, what's going on.
Sure.
And this one's kind of a little behind schedule, you know.
Yeah. So we got 5 days behind.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, that's anyway. Got to be one of the longest missions ever.
That was a long one for me, and I kept thinking, you know, I just thought, when in the hell are they going to be able to come and get us? You assume that, oh, well, tomorrow there'll be a break in the weather, after that, but no, it just kept being bad.
Well, we had that 5 days in the DMZ.
Yep.
And then a month earlier, we had 5 days like that in Laos, too.
Yep. Well, it moves in on you.
And so fast.
You can't get out. So anyway, that was a digression, but I just wanted to cover that.
Well, it's a precious moment. Yeah. Those are the things you
for
remember.
For me, it was what I remembered. Yeah. One of the things I remembered. Yeah.
Yeah. Because we had that one where we were in a firefight right down to the last light. We come home. Nobody's there. Because they had a floor show. Nobody gives a shit. Hey, it's a floor show. Come on over. Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay.
So.
But that's a moment. So how did this all begin? Where did it get you, A, interested in the Army at all, and B, where did you grow up as a kid?
I grew up in Orange, California, which for those not from California, it's just near Disneyland, near the city of Anaheim, small town at the time. And I was going to college at a junior college and was bored. You know, I was boredom. I knew Vietnam was going on, and I wanted to get some adventure and some action. So I didn't know anything about the military. I had no military background or knowledge or anything, and I thought about going into the Marine Corps.
Uniforms.
Yeah.
Best-looking uniforms out there. Yeah.
Yep. And but myself and three other guys joined as on the buddy system.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So we went in and just – we would all sit around talking about it, you know, and we just did it. And I was basic training up at Fort Ord. So
where does the SF thing come in? You get a recruiter comes through? We're looking for people?
A recruiter come through basic training. And what happened with me was that I was, in order to get in the military, because I was colorblind, I had to take a non-combat MOS. So when I went into basic, I was scheduled to be a clerk typist. No. Well, you know, one step at a time. Yeah. I didn't want to be a clerk typist, but that's all that I could do.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when the SF recruiter came in there, I'm going, yeah, I'll volunteer. Well, when I did that, they rerouted me and took me off of clerk typist and put me into the infantry, AIT, infantry training there at Fort
sure.
Ord. Yeah. So back in those days, it wasn't computerized. It was a little looser. They didn't pick up the fact that I was colorblind, and they, you know, sent me to infantry, AIT. So that's how I got going in that direction, you know. And from there, I went to jump school, and from there I went to training.
What was your time frame here?
I went in November of 66.
Yeah, I was in December.
November. Yeah, you and I went through training group together.
Indeed.
Yeah. So that's how it turned out. So I went from, and they never picked it up. They didn't. Nobody looked anymore about my color blindness. And by the time I went through jump school, that got passed over too. And so
perfect.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Then you arrived at Company A, Special
Company
Forces
A.
Training Group.
Yep.
Spider Parks was there.
Yep.
Tony Harrell. Who else? Rick Howard.
Rick Howard. I don't know.
Ron Owens?
Ron Owens was there.
Indeed.
Yeah. 20. Well, I don't know how big the class was. I'm jumping ahead in my thinking, but it was, I don't know, it was a pretty good size.
It was.
Common class, yeah.
Yeah. Of course, did you get recycled? Because McIntyre and I got recycled. We were just slow on it. And we had Sergeant First Class Villarosa that was
Villarosa, yeah. He was an instructor there.
But he helped us when we got recycled.
No, I didn't get recycled.
No, you were good. You were a quick learner,
yeah.
Right? As opposed to us dunderheads.
Not that quick. But so that was it. I thought you and I graduated at the same time, but I guess what happened was I got hurt. Maybe that's why we resynced, because
right.
I got hurt.
With the
minor
FTX?
Thing. No, I was screwing around and hurt my arm, and that took me out for a couple of weeks, I think.
And then we had TDY down in Georgia for 12 weeks.
Yep.
Then we had a week leave, a month leave.
Yep.
And then at the end of April, 68, we all landed at the Trang.
Yeah, yeah. For some reason, I came in one day before you guys. So
is that right?
Yeah, I think there was 23 or 24 of us that all went down there together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we had the first night in country get mortared.
Yep. Mortar came in. Welcome to Vietnam.
Indeed. Took out some of your dis next door.
Yeah, 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 yeah. That was my first, I was just getting...
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Settled in, you know, and then we
had both of us. Like,
yeah.
And then we go down to the weapons room to go through the wall, and the weapons room was locked.
Yep, yep.
And just watched, went out.
Sitting ducks.
Yeah. So do you remember that experience when you're done with the in-country training,
mm-hmm.
how you volunteered, how the recruiter comes out and says, we're looking for volunteers or something
yeah.
like that?
You know, people don't believe it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I know that some people have heard it, but it was really true. When we got into Nha Trang, I wanted to get in the field. I wanted some action. I didn't
yeah.
want to be a radio operator in a B team or something like that, you know.
Sure.
And so I'm asking around, and quite a few of us were asking around, how do we get out of this? Otherwise, we're going to get stuck, you know, in some headquarters company. And they said, well,
yeah.
You can get some action. There is a unit you can go to. You got to volunteer, you know. And so I don't remember talking to anybody about it, but I volunteered, and a lot of us volunteered for CNC detachment. And you try to find out what it was or what they did. Nobody would tell you. They wouldn't
no,
tell you a damn
no.
thing, you know. And then they got us all together in that room and gave us some.
By the time it was in Da Nang.
Yep, that was in Nha Trang?
No, it was Da Nang. We went
Da Nang?
Up for the briefing.
Okay.
Yeah. They had House 22, and then they drove us over in the morning.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. So we sat there, and they gave us the briefing, and we signed off on secrecy.
20-year NDA.
Yep. Yep. And off we went, you know. And then they sent us off to different places within CNC detachment. And I took that signature, that secrecy signature, I just didn't say anything about it for the next 20 years. And,
yeah.
And then it came out. I mean, bit by bit it came out. But, yeah, so
for
off
sure.
I went. And
yeah.
I went to Quezon. And so we got split up in different
oh,
directions. Yeah.
yeah. And Quezon, I mean, just what was it like being there as a, you know, going in? We had FOB3 was there.
Yeah.
And Quezon's known for the Marine Corps base that was
right,
there.
Right, right, right.
We had a separate, outside of their wire, separate wire between the two bases.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
they didn't like our little people being around.
They wouldn't allow them on their bases. They
right.
didn't let they didn't let any of our people, even though we would be with them, and we, you know, but they didn't.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't let them.
And what was it like being regularly rocketed and mortared every day?
Well, when I left Da Nang, they told me when you get to Quezon, you know, when you get there, whatever, if you're in an aircraft and the aircraft leaves, the aircraft will drop you off and take off, or if you come in vehicle, get out of the vehicle and run like hell, you know.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what I did. I didn't know anything about it, but when I got there and I pulled in the gate, holy shit, there it was like the moon. There was nothing left. It had all been bombed away, you know,
sure.
during Tet.
So you drove up from Fubai?
Yeah, I drove up from Fubai. And so I pulled in there, and I was driving a deuce and a half pulling a trailer. And I pulled over to the side, and I just took off and headed for a trench. And that's all there was trenches, you know.
Sure, yeah.
And I got in there, and then things kind of calmed down. But every day that I was there, you take incoming. You couldn't. There was no way to have a concentration of troops of any size, or they'd lob one on you, you know. So that was routine. You know, that was just the way it was.
And your bunkers were deep enough that
everything was down under, and you didn't stick your head up unless you had to, you know.
Right. We had one guy that did sit on his bunk.
Yeah.
And got hit with a piece of shrapnel.
Yeah.
They came in from a rocket or something and took
him out. Well, the commo room and some of the central offices were, shit, they had big rocks and all kinds of reinforcement over the top of them, you know. But some of the other stuff was not quite as well protected.
Right.
And so, but I didn't, you know, I didn't get hit by anything while I was there. I tried to be as careful as I could.
So on that first time up there, you drive a truck up,
yeah.
a deuce and a half.
Yeah.
But was there another time that you had to drive a deuce and a half up to Quezon under somewhat different circumstances?
Well, no, that was my trip to Quezon. That was only one of those.
This is like, it's not really a war story, but it sure is a story.
It's crazy. So,
how's this all begin then?
Well, here we go.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay, here we go. you guys are not going to believe this. I got sent to Quezon, and I was sent over to House 22, which
is a safe house in Da Nang.
Yeah, safe house in Da Nang. And I was told over the wait, somebody would come and pick me up. So myself and John Smith, Smitty, we call him Smitty,
right,
and a supply sergeant by the name of Charlie Tarr, we're all going to go to Quezon. We waited, and after a couple of days, we hear our names being called down at the bottom of the door, you know, the entry door.
Right.
Sergeant Estes, Sergeant Tarr, Sergeant Smith. And those two guys, we had the equipment to drive up to Quezon. And they got the, one of them drove a Jeep and one of them drove something else. And
so it was a small convoy. But you had the deuce and a half?
I had the deuce and a half and the trailer of rations for the club was really what it was for, and then the kitchen. So,
and just for people, deuce and a half is a 2.5-ton military truck.
Yeah, yeah.
Stick shift.
Yeah.
Canvas top.
So they were in the convoy out of Da Nang. They were already there, and myself and Potter and the Jeep, that was a medic Jeep with the cross on it, you know?
Sure.
And
regular ambulance.
Yeah, yeah. It looked like an ambulance. And a Vietnamese girl was there, and she was in an Arvin Army uniform. Yeah.
But it's not an ordinary co. This is
no,
one of
she
possible
has some special traits.
Special
yeah,
talents,
yeah.
Yes, yes. Some would say ill repute.
Yeah, that's exactly what she was.
But she's dressed up for this occasion in an Arvin uniform.
Yep, she's in an Arvin uniform. So none of this made any sense to me, but I'm in with Potter, and he says, we got to get out of Da Nang and get into that convoy to go to Fubai, which was the next stop on the way to Quezon.
Indeed.
And it started getting dark, and the reason that he was in a hurry and tried to avoid any Vietnamese checks was the girl. He was trying to get out of Da Nang with the girl in the Jeep. The closer it got to dark, the faster he drove. And pretty soon he was hauling ass all over Da Nang, going down roads. If he saw a checkpoint, he'd turn around and go back and then go down to the next one. She got scared, and she was just as you mentioned, you know, she was a prostitute that he had found there in Da Nang and paid her mamasan with club money. You know, they gave him the money to buy food and liquor, and instead he spent it on this prostitute. So she's in the Jeep, and pretty soon she starts bawling and carrying on, and he's telling her to shut up He says, "You shut your mouth." He says, "I paid a lot of money for you, and you do what I say." So he had her get an IV, a fake IV, hanging from the top of the Jeep,
right,
and run the tube
yeah.
down to this roll of blankets
yeah.
to make it look like she was giving an IV to a guy.
Sure.
So this is what she did, and she's crying and carrying on, claiming he's dinky now and trying to get me to do something about it, and I had no idea what the hell was going on. And we got out. We got out of Da Nang. We made the convoy, and then the next day we headed for Khe Sanh. The problem was is that as I got north of Phubai, everybody in my convoy, that's Smitty and the lieutenant and Charlie, were ahead of me. I was the last
yeah.
guy, and I'm driving the deuce and a half with the rations. And we were on an elevated road going through the rice paddies.
Right. Oh.
And it got higher and higher, and it got narrow. Well, I flipped the damn trailer of liquor and rations.
And rations.
And over she went. I cut the convoy in half. Everybody behind me then couldn't go forward, you know,
right.
because we were in the rice paddies. And the brew smelled the broken liquor, the local villagers, you know, that were around there.
Yeah, yeah.
So they ran up and they started stealing it. And I jumped out of the truck they gave me an M16 down in Nha Trang when I came in. I jumped out of the truck. I'm running around telling them, trying to get them to stop it. I'm waving the rifle and all this stuff. And I call for the Marines. There were Marines in the convoy. I said, "Hey, you guys, get over here and help me stop these brew from stealing all the booze." The Marines came over and they started stealing. So at that point, the brew were stealing. I was running around the truck. Finally, a Marine gunny came over there and he put a stop to his Marines stealing, and they helped me chase the brew off. We got the trailer. We all got together and pushed the trailer back up.
Oh my God.
But at that point, I had cut the convoy in half with my wreck. And we had to go back to Phubai, and then the next day we went on up to Khe Sanh. Well, when we got to Khe Sanh, that's when I mentioned I drove in the gate and ran like hell.
Yeah,
the lieutenant that had put all this together and spent the
lieutenant
club
Potter.
Money.
Yeah,
that was him. he was standing at parade rest, guarding the girl who he brought up there, and Colonel Barr had just taken command of Khe Sanh, and he booted both of them out, told them to get out of the camp and go someplace else.
He's not happy about her presence.
He didn't like it one bit. And so that was how I got to – that's my grand entry into Khe Sanh, yeah.
Oh, my God. That's just too funny.
That was funny. It was crazy at the time. I'm thinking that nobody would believe this.
No. And so, tragically, Lieutenant Potter was one of the 16
yeah.
KIAs on yeah. August 23rd, 68,
yep.
when during the attack at FOB4.
Yeah, yeah.
And fortunately, you and I both missed that. At least I missed it. You were up north, too, then.
I was at Mylock.
Yeah, okay.
I was at Mylock at the time, yeah.
And so, during this time, they closed Khe Sanh, FOB3 was closed at the end of June.
Mm-hmm.
Then they opened Mylock.
Right.
And then did you go over with a team or did you just go over as part of the transition?
I was just part of the transition. I was still doing radio.
And Clyde Sincere, the Major Sincere was the OIC for Mylock. You had to put that together.
Yeah.
Go from red clay to mud at Mylock. A lot of mud.
A lot of mud, yeah. In fact, that's one of the few pictures I got as we were trying to put up some buildings and stuff. The dozer got stuck and was
the bulldozer got stuck?
The bulldozer was like 75% covered, you know.
Whoa.
I mean, it dropped way down. So, I've got some good pictures of that. Slimy mud in Mylock. That was pretty primitive. I mean, it was out there kind of all by itself.
Sure. And, but also, they ran missions out of there.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, one of the more tragic missions of our time there was November 30th when they lost a mission for eldest son. Yep. Were you still at Mylock for that by that
no,
time?
No, by that time I had, I was at Phubai.
Right.
I was at Phubai and was supposed to go on that mission, myself and Rick Howard.
Yeah, the day before, and Lynn Black and Tim Schaaf, a couple others were scheduled.
There didn't seem to, it was an insertion, eldest son insertion.
An eldest son is ammo that's rigged to explode when the enemy uses it.
Yeah, we were going to, it was all pretty simple, we were going to put it along the trail And we got, again, weather, you know.
Sure.
We had been scheduled twice, 2 days, to go out, and then we got scrubbed because of weather, and they said, we'll try it again tomorrow, and they got scrubbed, and then they launched out of Mylock.
Yeah, it's right around Thanksgiving.
The whole chopper went down, yeah.
Yeah. So we were down TDY at FOB6 at the time. And then we were literally in the field, and they pulled us out after the word came down and said, you got to get back to FOB1.
Yeah.
Just lost six guys or seven guys.
Seven guys, I think. And that was a terrible.
That hurt.
Was terrible.
Entire Kingby crew.
Yeah, we, Rick and I looked at each other, you know. There's not anything you can say.
It's no, just, but by the grace of the Lord, one day earlier, that could have been you.
That was.
You got shot out of the sky with anti-aircraft weaponry.
Yeah, nothing you can do about it. You know, just the way war is.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, so.
So when they closed FOB1, you also moved down to, CCN. FOB4 was changed to CCN.
Yeah.
And you came down there with Crusader?
I came down there with Crusader, yeah.
And you had that one mission. Any other missions that stick out in your mind at this time?
None of the ones that I did. I ran, you know, I strap hung when I could.
Sure.
We had a couple other routines. Nothing of any real significance. I was scheduled to go to the Mugia Pass.
Oh, one of those deals.
Yeah, and so I got ready to go. And we started training for it and talking about it and looking at the aerials and all of that. And then they took us down to Saigon, and there was myself and I think Doug Gottschall said, I think he said he was on it. There were like four teams picked to do it. And I came back. I did a VR. I flew over. I went to NKP and then went out over the AO. But it never happened, you know. It never happened. And finally, I Deerost. I came home.
Right. Yeah. So when you flew over Mugia Pass, what was that VR like? Did you take anti-aircraft fire there?
No, we didn't take any anti-aircraft fire. The pilot was very evasive, I'll put it that way. He was good. He was good.
Yeah.
And he kept asking me if he said, you know, you want a bag, a puke bag, you know.
Sure.
And I said, nah, that's all right. I don't get sick. I'm blah, 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 blah. You know, I got sicker than shit. I said, hey, man, I got to open the window here and get some fresh air. But anyway, we went out and we took a look at it. It was pretty dicey. The whole thing was pretty dicey. And we were up quite a ways up.
Well, the plan was to put you on top of a plateau.
Yep.
Heavy with claymores.
Yep.
Et cetera. And this way, monitor traffic, call an airstrike. But again, the key would be weather. You would need clear weather to execute that.
Yeah,
because that Mugia Pass was one of the most narrow passes of the supplies coming from North Vietnam into Laos.
Yep.
And from there, we go down the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Yep.
Critical pass. The Air Force pounded it. And the reason why I'm a little bit familiar with it, too, is the picture on the cover of On the Ground. We were being inspected and briefed on that target. Same thing. And that was April of 69. But we weren't briefed like you to have four teams to talk about it.
Yeah, they, you know, I think Art Driscoll was in on that too. I don't remember exactly.
Right.
I just kind of paid attention to my part. But it was serious, but it was also like very political. They were afraid that somebody might get picked up as a POW up there. They were concerned about that part. And of course, we were. Out of country, you know.
Sure, yeah.
So it never, and as I understand it, it never went down. It never happened. But they had the State Department clearance, and they had some CIA operatives, but they weren't Americans. You know, they had some CIA contacts over there with getting some intel, but no, that was pretty dicey. And then the ability to get you out was different too.
Absolutely.
It was a long, long, long ways away.
So, oh, yeah. That would have been the most further north target of any SOG team.
Yeah.
Absolutely, because across the DMZ River, I forget how far up now.
It was a long ways up. It was quite a ways
It was
up.
A ride.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we briefed on it. It's like, well, okay, we'll try anything once.
Once,
the claymores and have the 60 mortars. We're going to take those with us, too.
Yeah.
And then we got canceled. We had gone up to Fubai at the Camp Eagle. To launch out of there.
Yeah.
And then they pulled the plug on it. Something happened. Like, we I think we had aircraft shot down. That's why I was asking about the anti-aircraft.
Yeah. No, we didn't take any anti-aircraft. He was a good pilot.
So at what point you get out of the Army, go forward, and you get into a civilian career, and then you also stayed in the National Guard.
I went back into, not the National Guard, but the Reserves, you know.
Okay,
yeah,
yes.
Army Reserves, yeah. I went back in. I took a break. I was busy doing what you do, you know. I got married and had kids, and we were...
The process of making a family of five.
Yeah, working. That's right. I was on the way to a family of five, just working. But then I went back in and hopefully seeing some of my old buddies.
Sure. That was with the 12th Group, 12th Special Forces Group?
Yeah, with the 12th Group.
Reserve
yeah.
unit at that time.
But there was I didn't see any of my old friends, but I made new ones, and I enjoy those kind of people, you know.
At this point, I have to ask you, Rick, when did you get the most serious injury of your military career?
In the reserves.
Which, you had a whole tour of duty with SOG.
Yeah.
Survived Quezon, FOB-1, and almost went to the Mugia Pass.
Yeah.
And talk a little bit about your time there getting
We were on a routine training exercise out of Los Alamitos, California.
Mm-hmm. Right. Down, the base for your reserve.
Yeah, unit. Yeah, that's where we reported. And there was a aviation unit that flew us out there. They were getting some flying time for them, and we went out and just did. We were going to do some routine training, and we did. We sent us up to Bishop, California, which is right at the base of the Sierras, about 250 miles north of LA. And coming home, myself and part of my team. I was a COMO guy, a COMO sergeant.
Sure.
And the helicopter crashed. The pilot was doing some maneuvers from Vietnam.
And we didn't know.
Yeah. He was showing off, I think. In my opinion, that's what he was doing.
But
I didn't know him. We didn't know him. They were an aviation unit. So the helicopter crashed and got totally destroyed. And at the time, I think I went out for a few minutes because I thought it was just a matter of seconds. But when I came to, my seat had collapsed and I'd hit the floor. My team sergeant got ejected from the helicopter and he died.
Wow.
Bill Miranda, great guy. Yeah, he got thrown out. The weapons man, Jimmy Ellington, who was sitting across from me in the Huey, he broke his back clean from the nipples down. And Jimmy died about 3 years later. And George Lim, who I didn't know at the time, but he was the crew chief. And he got ejected out of the helicopter too and went into the mud face first. When I realized that we had crashed the way we had, like it knocked me silly, and I looked around and I could see fuel spewing out of the gas tank. And it scared the shit out of me. And,
oh, yeah.
So I took a dive out of the helicopter to try to get away from it because I was sure it was going to go up. And what I didn't know was that I'd broken my ankle. And what happened was I fell right into the fuel, right into the goddamn fuel. So there I was, and I had one of those military sweaters on, and I'd soaked it up. And then some of the guys, we had another chopper in the formation. They sat down, they came, they picked me up, took me out of the fuel, and set me off to the side. And then basically at that point, I had what they call a flailed chest. You know, I had a broken ankle and a flailed chest, and my lungs collapsed. I spent a little less than a month in the hospital, and then I got out. So that was, for me, it was, you know, I recovered pretty well. But Bill... We lost Bill, you know, and we lost Jimmy later.
Sure,
later, so.
3 years later.
Yeah. So that was it.
Yeah, that was it. And then, but dedicated servant to our country that you are, you stayed in.
Stayed in.
And then when you're, let me make sure I get this right. When you were age 58.
Age 58.
You deployed to Iraq.
I went to Iraq at 58, yeah.
Talk a little bit about that, sir. I mean, that's still just amazing. I mean, the numbers.
Yeah.
Just a little different. I mean, you're still deploying. 30 years after Vietnam.
Yeah, I know.
35 years.
It came as a surprise, you know. It just said you've been mobilized, or you've been. I think the order.
Because you're still in 12th.
No, at that point,
you're going to SOCOM.
I was with SOCOM. Yeah, I had transferred out of the 12th. I was drilling out of MacDill, and was with SOCOM.
So you had to fly over to MacDill just for your drills then?
Yeah. Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah, but I didn't have to go every month. I would go down there and spend a month or a month and a half. I was self-employed, and I could worked it out that way. It was better that way. And so I got the orders, and I had 30 days to get ready. And
I remember your going away party.
Yeah, you came to my going away party.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
like, yeah. You're going to do what?
Yeah,
when Becky called and said, we're going to have this going away party.
Yeah, her and I.
Yeah, so is he going to go to France? He always talked about it. No, he's going to Iraq.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So we we went over there, and I spent, I didn't spend a full year. I spent like 9 months. That was the orders. And
yeah.
I started off at BIOP, there by the BIOP base, and it was one of Saddam's palaces, Rodwania Palace, and that's where...
And what year was this again?
03,
04?
I got there in December of 03, and I came home in 04, yeah.
Yeah.
So we started off at the Rodwania Palace, and then I went on R&R, and when I came back, the decision had been made to relocate to Balad, the big airbase. And so from that point on, I spent quite a little bit of time getting things ready over there at the new location, and then I just worked in operations.
So by then, you're an E-8 Master Sergeant,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I was a Master Sergeant, yeah.
So what was your role there?
Well, there I worked with, I was a liaison with the teams that were in the field.
Right.
And no field duty for me. I was at 58. They kept me in. Wisely kept me inside. And when I was at Rodwania, I was an LNO for SOCOM. I think the first CAV was there, and you've heard of Camp Victory there,
sure.
Right outside of Baghdad.
Right.
Yeah. So I was the LNO. I was a liaison with them and one other major unit. And so,
wow.
So I came in there and briefed them on what SOCOM was doing.
Certainly.
Yeah.
So then you come back home, and during that time, did you have your real estate company up and running by that time, or were you doing another entrepreneurship thing?
No, I had the real estate company, and I came back and took over. I had a friend that stepped in for me as the broker, and I told him and my manager, I said, you know, from the time I get on the chopper or the time I get on the aircraft, I'll put all of this out of my mind until I come back. And I did, you know,
sure.
I didn't think about it. I figured, you know, it'll either be there when I get back or it won't be. But I didn't worry about it, you know. And it was still there. It was still there.
So you had your real estate company up in Riverside County.
Yeah.
And when did all that start? How long have you been doing that?
Oh, I got into real estate when I was about 30 years old. Pretty quick, you know. And I basically stayed in it the rest of my life. The company was I'd been doing property management for about 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, but my entire career was real estate, other than just a few years as a young guy out of the military, you know.
Sure.
Yeah.
This is all before you became a vintner.
This is before I became a vintner, yeah. That's a hobby vintner. Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But you take a lot of grief in that, but I've heard compliments about your wine, so.
Well, it's taken a long time. I'm in 11-year mark right now, and I'm still working on it.
Is it 11 years already?
Yeah, it's been 11 years. Well, you came out and visited once.
Yeah,
very
beginning, yeah.
Yeah.
But you had like 113 trees, and you had a couple of saplings, somebody that you're just getting started.
I was just getting started. I ended up with 240 vines, something like that, and it makes a lot of wine. And so I bottle up several hundred bottles a year. Just give it.
Sure.
I give it to friends and my kids and anybody that'll take it. You know, it's been pretty good the last few years. Yeah.
Outstanding.
But it wasn't in the early part.
No. And then during that time too, you and I, Rick Howard, a bunch of other guys, all joined the Special Operations Association.
Yeah.
And you served as president for 6 years.
That's crazy.
It is.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well,
and you're still relatively sane. No, I only did it for 3 years.
I know.
You did six.
Yeah, Well, you actually, you're the one that told me about SOAR, and we all got together. Some of us got together that first time. I don't know how many years ago that's been, but many,
like 20
years
or 21. That's the time we went up with Billy Hoops, right?
Yeah. Oh, no, before. I think we were going before that. Yeah, okay. We did go with Billy, yeah. And, I did it for 6 years. And that was enough.
Indeed. So it looks like we're heading down the home stretch here.
Yeah.
Is there anything else at this point, either in terms of reflection or thoughts on family or anything else about your career or what brought you into the top special operations group during the Vietnam War? Now that you can talk about it. For 20 years, we couldn't.
Yeah, yeah. No other than the quality of the people. I can't imagine a better group of people to know and to serve with than what I did there. They, you know, you talk about having somebody's back or something like that, and that's the one thing that you go in, you know that they're going to come and get you if they can.
Oh, yeah.
And so that makes you, you know, that's a lasting, the lasting friendships, people that you met there and you never forget. And as we get older, there's fewer and fewer of them. But, I mean, they're still just like, they're in some ways, they're even closer than family. It's the damnedest thing, but that's true. You know?
Well, being under enemy fire
and
living to talk about it another day
clearly
has its own dynamic.
Yeah, yeah. So I just had the, you know, great, great people. It was an experience of a lifetime.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Well, with that thought, sir, we'll close it up here and we want to give our thanks to all the men and women in our armed services who have fought and bled for this country. We also thank the Border Patrol, law enforcement, first responders, EMT, corrections officers, and just anybody out there fighting to do the right thing in our country today. And we thank the men and women who have served in years past, men like Rick Estes that have served our country. We're grateful for that. And we also remember and salute the men and women who have not been able to return that are amongst the 1,581 service members still missing in action today in Southeast Asia from the Vietnam War, 50 of which were Green Berets from the Secret War. And again, as always, we thank Jocko Willink Productions and his staff for making all this possible in conjunction with SOG Chronicles. Until next time. God bless America.
God bless America.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.